Most of us love the idea of traveling, but between the constraints of money, time, and the hustle and bustle of day-to-day life, few of us ever get to visit all of the places we'd like to experience. On this show, Phil and Pete have conversations with interesting people who have, and do, live in some of the most remote and exotic locales on the planet. Together, we'll travel the world from the privacy of your earbuds in Vicarious Encounters.
In our last episode, we did part one of this interview.
And now it's time for part two.
So you mentioned earlier that acquiring language was part of what was necessary in order to be able to function in this country. I understand that when you're learning language, a lot of times it doesn't go quite the way you hope initially. Were there ever times when you said things that you later found out maybe weren't as articulate or fluent as you hoped?
Oh yeah. You know, for a while we were preaching through translators, and even afterwards, when I was an absolute ace crack expert at the language and I was trying to preach, I would say the most amazing things and people would laugh, and I'd be like, okay, there goes another point on the sermon that I'm never going to understand what happened. Like one time I preached that the third point in the sermon was going to be like a Billy Graham moment. You know how you, I don't know if you've ever preached, but you think to yourself, God, it's going to be so great. This is going to be a history making moment for these people. They're going to hear this sermon and their lives are never, ever going to be the same. And I got up there, third point. Was going to be Jesus liberates us. But just one little tiny change in the just one letter, one sound different. And instead I said, Jesus is the thing that peels our heads. Yeah, you know, just they had the same reaction. They were just laughing and laughing and laughing. And, you know, one time I was in the village and I wanted to just say something real simple that he came after I did, you know, he followed me. But I got one letter wrong and I said he came right up my rear.
Oh, my.
Which is not what I intended to say. Not at all. And one time, you know, in this context, the Christians have this really cool tradition where they, every Christmas, since it's like 40 Christians and surrounded by Muslims, they invite all the Muslim leaders from the entire region to come, and they kill a cow and make a big batch of rice and sauce and different kinds of sauces, and they invite all these people, and they try to teach them about their religion. Is how they roll, and that's what they do. So they invited me one year to speak at this thing, and it was before I knew Yolunka. I spoke through an interpreter, and I blame Max Lucado for this one. He used a sermon illustration, and I heard it, and I thought it was sufficiently physical that it would make sense. You know, so he said one time, when God says, "Be holy as I am holy," that's kind of like telling everybody to jump to the moon. Some people can jump higher than others, but nobody can jump to the moon. It's just not possible. I thought, yeah, that's physical. That could translate. So I'm saying that in French, and a person is interpreting it. I get to that point, and everybody, all the leaders of all these villages are nodding their heads and looking at each other, and they're saying, I'm like, oh, it's working. This is church history being made. This is probably a people movement to Jesus Christ happening right here, right now. That's what I thought. It wasn't until a day later when somebody that I was sitting next to said, hey, do you remember that moment where everybody was saying, I was like, oh yeah, I do. He said, do you know why? And I was like, not sure. He said, well, you said that nobody can jump to the moon. Turns out the word for jump is the same word as the word for fly. No one can fly to the moon. And one of the tenets of kind of popular Islamic culture is that the moon is the symbol of Islam, and surely the Americans never flew to the moon. And all of those Apollo things that you saw on TV were just faked up. And right out of the American horse's mouth, I taught everybody that Neil Armstrong never went to the moon.
Oh, you accidentally became a conspiracy theorist.
I was the conspiracy theory myself. I did it. I said it. It confirmed everything they ever knew about this. And frankly, it's Max Lucado's fault. I don't know what he was thinking.
Yeah, I don't mind blaming him either.
Yeah, it seems reasonable.
That guy. I don't know where what he thought.
So I would love to know about a favorite memory. Like when you think back in your time in the country, a moment that just every time you think about that moment, it just makes you smile.
Well, you know, every interaction with my friends makes me smile, I think. You know, we're on, I could tell you about hunting warthogs and running alongside a warthog for 200 or 300 yards, talking to him. That was a great moment. But I think let's go with kind of an intercultural funny thing that happened. One time I was preaching and, I was doing another metaphorical example. And I said, why did God give us hands, you know, arms? And they said to work hard with. And I said, why did God give us legs? And I said, to walk long distances. And I said, why did God give us heads? And they said, to carry heavy loads. I was like, bro, that's not where I was going with that. and they all started kind of looking around at each other like, that's not where he was going with that, was he? And it became like a, between me and this one guy in the church, it became like a running inside joke, because this buddy of mine, he would be like, there we go again, using our heads to carry heavy loads instead of thinking, you know.
Wow.
I could tell you about 100 different things. Well, another really key, beautiful moment. When I went there, you have to have some way of like some kind of model or mental way of describing why you're there and who you are. And you know, competing models arise. Like one carpenter said, no, you know, this is humanitarian aid. I was like, no, bro, this is not humanitarian aid. I hired you to make that door. And you know, they would come up with, what are you? And for me, I finally tell people, listen, I'm a neighbor. I'm your neighbor. Because everybody needs a neighbor who has resources. You know, I'm your neighbor. And everybody would like to have a neighbor. I wanted to be the kind of neighbor that they wanted to have. Somebody that you could go to if you had a medical problem, and he'd be like, well, I don't know much, but let me look at your thing and see if I can help you figure out what to do. Or if somebody had a spiritual problem, they could say, you know, let me ask you about, or if somebody needed some food, you know, like one day my neighbor's kid was crying. And I went over there. She had been cooking mice to eat. And she was wailing, and I said, what's wrong with Yerba? And they said, oh, her brother stole her papaya. And I remember thinking, I don't even like papayas. You know, this kid is wailing. She's starving, you know. And so people in that situation, they need a good neighbor. And I remember we were leaving for our first home assignment, and these men came over to the village, to the house, and they greeted me, and there's a group of three or four of them, and they said, listen, being your neighbor is sweet. And I just remember that was just like a beautiful moment where I had been trying to promote this idea that I'm just one of your neighbors. And somehow I hadn't really said it out loud much, but for me, that was what I wanted to act like. And the message had got across, you know, they were saying, hey, we love having you as our neighbor. It's really sweet. Kind of similar to that. I remember at a funeral, one of the things they do is they collect money and then they distribute the money to different people in the village. And this guy gets up, and I'll never forget what he said. This guy says, and this 500 francs is for the white man, the Tubabu. Because no matter how wealthy you are, there's something you could never give yourself, and that's respect.
Mm.
I mean, I learned a lot from these guys. I really, really did. And those were sweet moments.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
I feel like maybe it is we've already gotten a glimpse, but if you had to key in on what you miss most about that country now that you are no longer there, would it just encapsulate those relationships, or how would you expound on that?
Yeah, I would say the relationships, the ability to just walk out my door and with a rifle over my shoulder, you know, my neighborhood association hates that. My neighbors don't care.
In Texas, I'm surprised it's not okay.
You know, there's a certain liberty in chaos that you cannot match in the land of the free, because you're not free in the land of the free. You know, if I were to get out there with a hoe in my yard and hoe peanuts in the front yard, they would say, no, you cannot hoe peanuts in the front yard. And I would say, hey, what? Why not? I mean, this is producing food for my family. No, you're not allowed. There's so much you can't do. But in that context, you're truly free. You know, you're truly at liberty to do whatever it is. And I loved being there with those people and enjoying that freedom and living literally off the grid, where everything was, if you had it, you had it because you had brought it there, or you had made it, or you had, if you had electricity, it was because you knew how to make electricity. If you had water, it was because you knew how wells worked and you could pump water into that well and into your water tower. And just that independence and that liberty and that community, being in that small context where we were all, you know, in relationship with each other. And when somebody died, we all went and cried together. And when somebody was born, we all celebrated together. And when it was just beautiful, pure community experience that I feel like we've just lost.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So how have the lessons that you learned there about community impacted who you are now?
I learned a lot from African leaders. I'm a leader now, and I haven't been involved in anything for very long before they put me in charge of it. And I learned a lot of powerful, important lessons from African leaders. I feel like give me relational advantages. And I learned how to not dishonor people in an honor shame culture like that. You know, one time I spent the night stopped at a police checkpoint, and in the early morning hours, I went over and I said, hey, am I ever going to get my papers back? And they said, come with me. And they took me into the back of this police station. And I thought, this is it. I'm going to die back here in the back of this police station. It's dark. And they take me to the very back. And there's this enormous man laying on a cot, a military chief, general, captain, I don't know what. And he stands up without his shirt on. He's massive. And he comes outside and they say, Captain so-and-so, this man has been here all night, and such a people over there across the street took his paper. And he just kind of slowly, regally walked out, stood in the middle of the intersection, and he kind of extended his hand out, and just with a couple of fingers, you just sort of come, like you just made this gesture. And those people came across the street, and he said, "You did a very good thing taking this man's paperwork. Now give it back." And I was just in awe of this man, for one thing, that he didn't, you know, he didn't shame them for what they had done, but they knew that they what he was saying maybe was just a little bit of a subtle way of saying, hey, you might want to think about not doing that again, you know. But he said it in such an artful way that, you know, it just made me think about honoring people and not shaming them and guarding their dignity in the process of exerting authority. I thought, you know, that's this something to be learned from these men.
That's awesome. Okay. So this is the sort of wrap-up travel question for you. If you had 2 weeks, all expenses paid, to go anywhere you have not yet been in the world, where would you go?
I don't know. I have not yet been. That really limits it. I would.
That's an impressive statement in and of itself.
I would go to Indonesia. Because I've never been there, never been close enough to that spot. And I think that would be a great place to learn more stuff.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, now it's time to move on to our next segment of the podcast, which is our top five. I have to confess, we created a top five this week that gave me an unfair advantage over the other two folks today. It's our top five movies from before you were born. And I've got an extra 10 years to pick from. I could have chosen Star Wars and did not. So that's giving me dating my age a little bit. I could have chosen Star Wars, but I did not, because it would not make my top 100. And 50 or 200 movies, but that is neither here nor there. So top five movies from before we were born. And I think we should each preface maybe with when we were born, so people know what we are working with.
Number five.
I was born in 1978. So everything is going to come before that year. My number five is Casablanca. Casablanca is, in my mind, the quintessential American movie. I feel like you have to, you fall down on either the Casablanca or the Citizen Kane side of that discussion. And I think Citizen Kane is pretentious, and I think Casablanca is wonderful. So that is my number five. Pete?
I was born in 1966. So you got a 12-year advantage on me. And I have, so when you just suggested this as a top five, I thought, oh gosh, I don't even know if I know five movies from before I was born off the top of my head. And so I Googled good old movies, and Casablanca is, by many people's account, a great movie. And my wife assures me that we've seen it. And I'm probably going to go back and watch it at some point, but I can't honestly say that it's one of my top five. I'm going to say for number five, my number five is Rear Window. It's an Alfred Hitchcock film. It's actually quite a simple concept, but it's a very interesting film. It was remade more recently, but the original is still my favorite. So that's going to be my number five. Greg?
I could have populated my entire top five with Alfred Hitchcock movies if I had gone that route. I love his films, so that's a great choice. Sorry, Greg?
I'm not a huge movie buff, but I picked The Great Escape. Probably because of the really cool motorcycle jumping over fences scene.
Yeah.
That is a movie I have never seen. So I have to confess, not
Phil,
seen it.
Phil, you're
apparently
missing,
I should.
Missing out.
Number four.
Okay, my number four, with all apologies to Akira Kurosawa, my number four is The Magnificent Seven. I love Yul Brynner. I love all of the movies, all movies where the plot setup is, hey, let's get this team together and each person has sort of their special, this is the thing they do, and they come together and they are better as a whole than they are individually because they complement one another. And I saw The Magnificent Seven when I was very, very young. And so I think it is what has imprinted on me my love for that type of story. So that is my number four.
Phil, by the same reasoning, you could have gone with The Three Amigos.
Yeah, that's much much later than when I was born. I think that was 1987.
I'm just saying that's in the same genre. Actually,
it's also a great movie. much better songs in that movie than in The Magnificent Seven.
I'm going to say The Magnificent Seven. That's a good choice. I should have thought of that one.
For me, I'm going to say my number four is Bridge Over the River Kwai. I like great war films, and I particularly enjoy this one. There's a number of scenes in that film that, despite the fact it's been a long time since I've seen it, still remember that very favorably. Well acted, and definitely creates a strong emotional response, particularly for older films. I feel like I don't get the same visceral response with a lot of them, but I really did with this one.
As a civil engineer, I think I should have picked that one. That is a really good one too. I mean, I could whistle the whole thing. Let's go with my number four, though, is Goldfinger. And I would say all James Bond movies before or after my birth, I probably would. I'm revealing maybe my shallowness, but I enjoyed those.
All right.
Number three.
My number three is I don't know if you would call it a musical. It's a quasi-musical with Danny Kaye, whom I think is hilarious. And that is The Court Jester. I love everything about the setup of that movie. And I'm very drawn to fast dialogue and clever wordplay. And that movie has it in spades.
Never seen that, I don't think.
Oh, it's worth your time. It's great.
So I'm going to pick The African Queen as my number three. I love the interplay between Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn. Still, when I think about that film, I still have like a mental image of them aboard that boat going down that river. It has such an intriguing, exotic feel, and it's a fascinating film to me. It's one of the few older films that truly I found engaging.
Okay, so as a Texan who attacks spitting cobras with leaf rakes, I should be more masculine than this, but I'm going to admit that every musical I have ever seen, I have loved. And The Sound of Music is my number three. And it's really more like a genre. It's like all of musicals. I was shamelessly into musicals all through high school. Not a popular thing with the guys, but that was my thing. I enjoyed it.
Well, I'm right there with you, to be perfectly honest. Like, I was raised on many of those musicals. I'm sure are the ones you're talking about, and I see later in your list you're going to talk about one that's one of my favorites. But yeah, I'm right there with you. There are some great great musicals from that era.
Number two.
My number two is my nod to Alfred Hitchcock, and I had to go. Rear Window is my second favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie. My favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie is North by Northwest. I just feel like he does something with the sort of spy chase thriller genre with this movie that I have not seen done anywhere else, and I absolutely love everything about it.
I'm going to say my number two is It's a Wonderful Life. Every time I watch that film, I am deeply moved. And to me, it raises such a profound question, and that is, how would the world be different if you'd never been here? And I think that's a timeless question, and I think it's worth asking. At least annually, you know, I watch the film and it encourages me to consider that question for myself. And sometimes it encourages me to make adjustments as a result of pondering that question.
I should see that movie at some point.
Yes, you should. <It's>, number two for me, Cool Hand Luke, because he's awesome. And Paul Newman, you got to have Paul Newman somewhere on your list, right? That's, he's locked in a prison and he's just so awesome that nothing can stop him until they kill him. But okay, I don't know. Maybe that's something reveals something about my psychoses.
That movie would have made my list if I'd been born 1 year later.
I actually watched that movie in my high school psychology class and discussed it. The whole egg eating thing was my favorite part of the movie.
Wow.
All right.
Number one.
All right. So I'm a huge movie fan. So for someone who is a huge movie fan, there are movies that are the kinds of things that you take into your inner being, and you can not only quote them line by line, but you can imagine them frame by frame. And that is this movie for me. My number one movie is the John Wayne film El Dorado. It is just, I loved it the very first time I saw it, probably younger than I should have, but that's a different discussion to have. But It's just resonated with me. It had just the right level of humor and excitement, and it just had everything. I just absolutely love the movie.
So my number one may seem like a cheat, but I looked it up, and it is widely regarded as a movie, even though people
it is widely regarded as a movie.
Actually,
that's
if you
a
go
qualification,
to Bard,
Phil. That's a qualification.
If you go to Bard, Google's Bard, and ask, "Is it a movie?" There is a lengthy discussion, and at the end, it says, "I regard it as a movie." So, I figured I'd get an objective third party.
That thing as a special every year my entire childhood. So I'm going to vote in favor.
All right.
Well, so tell us what it is.
So 8 months before I was born, A Charlie Brown Christmas came out for the first time.
Just and, under the wire there.
Just barely. Yeah. And I did not grow up in a family where I never went to church. I never knew anything about Jesus or the gospel. And so the first time I ever heard the story of who Jesus is and his birth was listening to Linus tell it on stage when he said, I can tell you what Christmas is all about. And for me, that was it. It to this day is one of the most deeply moving things I've ever seen on any screen, because it just taps a something very deep in my soul when I see it. And I was actually a little grieved when I think it was last year they announced that they were going to stop showing it annually on network television. And I thought, well, it had a great run, but that it feels a little sad to me.
Okay, so for me, very personal favorite. Fiddler on the Roof, which as a Broadway play started decades before my birth, but actually the movie itself is from 1971, when I was 3 years old. So I'm cheating a little bit. However, Fiddler on the Roof hits me in the gut every time I see it, just to watch this people going through what they go through and, you know, all of the songs. And I think maybe subconsciously I chose it or always liked it because, frankly, I am Tevye. I mean, that I am Tevye. Every so often, new people who are coming into my organization or company or whatever you want to call it will get on Facebook and say, is it just me or does Greg Pruitt look like that guy Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof? And I always, when I catch him doing it, I'll go on and I always say the exact same thing. I just type in there mysteriously, as the good book says, when a poor man eats a chicken, one of them's sick. And I just let that hang out there. And because that's a line from the movie, and I figure, you know, it's at this point it's become well known, I am Tevye. And I was played by a guy in Fiddler on the Roof. That's how I look at the movie.
Nice.
Oh man, I love it.
It's clearly a good choice because at least four different songs from the movie have played through my head as you were talking about it.
I'm telling you, you can't beat that movie. That's number one.
All right. I think that I have to give an honorable mention, considering Pete's discussion of a movie playing every year and your discussion of musicals. If I were to add a number 6 through 10, The Wizard of Oz would probably make that list for those two reasons. It was an annual watching event in my house as a child growing up.
The flying monkeys, man.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
I will never sleep soundly at night again. I've never slept soundly at night, and I now know, I remember, it's those dang monkeys.
Because you were hunting them while you were engaged.
That's right.
I have a reestablished dominance with a 36.
Perhaps there is a pathology to your hunting.
Yeah, okay. It all makes sense. I owe you guys a great debt of gratitude for this podcast because I've never done counseling, and this
free diagnosis.
This now, actually, I don't need to. This is it.
I would say we're dime store psychologists, but with Pete's mention of Charlie Brown, I guess we only charge 5 cents.
A nickel. Right.
Yeah.
I will be transferring a nickel through overzealous order to each of you.
So it'll be basically a dime because we each get a nickel. It's perfect.
There you go. Perfect. That seems reasonable.
You know, inflation.
Are you ready? It's time for another unpopular opinion.
So our final segment is our unpopular opinion, and I have loved some of the feedback I've gotten from many of our listeners who think that the most popular section of our podcast is our unpopular opinion. So thanks to those of you who have reached out and given some affirmation there. From one episode to the next, somebody either Phil or myself or our guest offers an unpopular opinion, something we know not everybody will agree with, but we have a conversation. We choose to disagree without being disagreeable. And I am delighted to say that this time it is not my unpopular opinion, but it's actually our guest that brings our unpopular opinion. So Greg, tell us your unpopular opinion, and then Phil and I will try to tell you why we agree with you or why we think you may be mistaken.
Okay, well, you're gonna think I have a thing with my homeowners association, and you'll be right. if you've lived in the chaos of Africa and done anything you wanted to and walked around in your former neighborhood with your 30-06, and now you can't do any of that stuff. The neighborhood doesn't like it. My observation is that everybody talks about how important biodiversity is. But if they really valued biodiversity, they would like my lawn. It's a prairie grass preserve. I'm applying to the federal government. I'm going to have to tell my homeowners association, listen, this is a federally protected prairie grass preserve. We can't.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We
that's
can't
awesome.
Mow this. It would destroy biodiversity.
Is that a legitimate thing that you can do? Like, you think that's gonna work?
I'll let you know, Phil.
That sounds awesome. I think that it's interesting. This is an interesting choice for an unpopular opinion, because I think in your generation, in my generation, this is an unpopular opinion, but the tides are turning on that. I think when I look at my students, they are definitely of the opinion that lawns are stupid, and why would we not do what we can to help the earth continue to grow instead of worrying about this? And as someone personally who would rather not mow, I'm perfectly okay with this opinion. I think it's great.
Trust me, Phil, it's unpopular.
And the HOA, I am sure.
It's very unpopular.
I have such mixed feelings about this, because I feel like this is one of those decisions that does affect other people in a way that is, that they feel very strongly about. I feel like it's hard for me to. So I love this opinion on a personal level, because I don't like mowing. I feel like mowing, the amount of time and effort and money and energy and water in a rather arid location.
Drinking water. You are dumping drinking water on the ground. What kind of savage country is this?
Yeah, it does feel wasteful. It feels like we're squandering valuable resources. And
you are filtering thousands of gallons of water and disposing of it on the soil.
Yeah, that's not false.
How could you?
But for me, I have to be honest, a big part of my motivation is laziness. I think,
I'm willing to admit it.
I'm also aware, though, that it's hard for me to be a good neighbor and adopt this philosophy because the people that live on both sides of me invest much more time and energy in their lawn, and my seeding weeds impact their lawns. I can't separate what's going on in my yard with what's going on in their yard. So I love your opinion as a matter of public policy, but as a matter of personal practice, I feel like it's hard to do that in a way that is not potentially offensive to my neighbors. So I'm a little conflicted on this.
I still mow my lawn, but I chafe.
I think becoming a federally protected prairie land is a perfect way to do that without, what can your neighbors do at that point?
if you are against the federal government, you'll end up in jail. So yeah, I think there's some potential there, but I haven't been able to figure out how to document that properly.
I mean, I started to think about the impact based on, I mean, you were talking about all the clean water that is being squandered in a place where we're currently experiencing drought conditions. I started to think about a couple of other things. I started to think about the amount of fossil fuels that are used up by people mowing in various different locations. I mean, if we changed our practice, if mowing was not a frequent practice, it would dramatically reduce our use of fossil fuels. I also thought about global warming, just how much unnecessary global warming is happening because we are prioritizing something that has no tangible human benefit.
If there was a jungle canopy over each person's yard, how much global warming and how much offsetting of carbon footprint would there be? I'm telling you, history will be on my side. But for now, I'm mowing the lawn.
It seems fitting, but that is a really fascinating unpopular opinion. I look forward to hearing from our listeners what they think about your unpopular opinion. So we're getting ready to wrap up this episode, but one of the things that we're going to start doing on our episodes is we're just going to ask our guests. We did this with one of our previous guests, and I'd like to do it with Greg as well. If you have anything that you're currently promoting or working on, things that you'd like our listeners to know about, Greg, what about you?
Well, Pete, I'm glad you asked. I happen to have written two books, and I'm really terrible at promoting them, but I'm going to make an exception just for your show. And I happen to have one sitting right here. It's the second book is the one I'm promoting. It's Extraordinary Hearing, Preparing Your Soul to Hear from God. It's a book about, you know, I wrote a book 9 years ago about prayer, and then I may have underestimated godly people, you know, your average person sitting in the pew, the profound spiritual questions they possess and find nowhere to really get good answers from. And I kind of wrote this book to try to answer some of those questions that people kept asking me. The first book assumed everybody knew how to hear from God, and the main topic of this book is to say, okay, I get it. Just assuming that you already know how to hear from God was probably a bad call on my part. And I wrote an entire book. At first, I remember saying, man, there's no way. What do I know about that? But then I realized that as a Christian leader in a Christian ministry, it was really my full-time job to discern the leading of the Holy Spirit for the organization and move in those directions. So I started asking myself the question, well, how does it work? You know, what am I doing? And, you know, what have I learned about this? And that's why I wrote this book.
So if So if someone has not read either book, would you recommend reading this new one first before going back to Extreme Prayer, which was the first one?
You know, you can read them in any order you want. They're not like a ordered thing. But I would recommend the first one, Extreme Prayer, because it's short. And universally, people have told me that the thing they like about the book is that it's short. And if you're an author, that's actually, that's not a compliment. That's not a compliment. You know, it's like, hey, what we like about your writing is there's not much of it. You know, that's not saying a lot. But, you know, I think that one's the easier read. And then this one if you, when you really want to sit down and say, okay, I got to do something about this spiritual life of mine. I really need to grow closer to God. This is a good book for that.
Well, I was listening to a podcast conversation yesterday. And one of the things they talked about is the phrase, our thoughts and prayers are with you. And they were talking about the fact that while, you know, obviously your take on prayer is distinctively Christian, that there is something very deeply woven into our culture about prayer. And prayer is you know, at least as a practice, is much broader than just a very specific understanding of prayer. That seems like a something that, you know, if you're listening to the podcast, whether you're a Christian or not, most of us have some interest in learning more about prayer. That sounds like a great place to start. So thanks for sharing that.
I think it's a human universal, aside from atheism, which is relatively recent. Any interaction with any culture I've ever had worldwide has revealed that human beings instinctively know that there's something, something out there, and they reach out in whatever way they can figure out to do it, with sacrifices to a tree, or there's just always in every culture an appeal to the unseen, that there's unseen powers. And we just seem to have that deep, instinctively ingrained in us somewhere. And this book might help you figure out how to realize that desire.
Well, I don't know about you, Phil, but I'm going to read it.
Now it is, it's available physically and digitally.
You know, you can get it for Kindle. You can get it any, just Google Extraordinary Hearing and I'll be like put my name on it and it'll be the top thing.
All right.
And we will add a link. We'll add a link to it when we start promoting the episode on our Facebook page and other socials as well.
Okay.
All right. Well, Greg, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. When Phil and I first started talking about this podcast, we talked about goals that we have, and we had an episode where we talked about that. But really, the truth is, my number one standard for what constitutes a good episode is how much fun Phil and I have recording it. And as far as I'm concerned, this was a raging success. Phil, what do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, this was a fantastic conversation. I've had the opportunity to hear you speak in the past, and even in that, I heard fresh and new things and different insights, and it was very, very good. I appreciate you being here.
All right.
My absolute pleasure.
Well, thanks so much for tuning in. If you would like to support our podcast, we're on Patreon. If you'd like to know more, we are on social media most of the time. If you're looking for an unpaid position, we're looking for somebody to run our social media. So feel free to reach out to us. Phil, any final words before we close?
No, if you would like to give us a potential idea for a future top five or unpopular opinion, you can send that to us through our socials, or you can email us at vicariousencounters@gmail.com. And I think that's about it, Pete. I hope that everyone enjoys listening, and we'll see you next time.